to the portfolio in particular. Yeah, because it connect dialogue. We appreciate your presence because maximum participation for us is very key in this portfolio committee so that we move in unison on issues. We are looking forward to see other opposition parties like IFP, for instance. We haven't seen them in the portfolio committee. So we want to see them so that we deal with these issues of international importance as a country and the representatives of parliament in unison. Today we are going to deal with the treaty. The department will present to us. I don't know why Luanda is sitting at the back. You are supposed to sit in these front benches here, not hide there, far away. And you are representing the ministry. Haibu. Indonjani leyo, Luanda. Come sit here. Don't hide. Akuna hangover. Maybe he's a novice. Myself, I don't like this chamber. Too big for our portfolio. Yeah. I'm not going to respond to that. Funasifo and easy. So let me welcome all of you and hand over to the department quickly so that they present. I'm not into long meetings because long meetings, they lack productivity. So short meetings are very key because you must leave the meeting with knowledge instead of exhaustion. So we are going to give you an hour to present, which I think is more than enough. And then we then going to allow honourable members to interact with your presentation, and then we'll be out of here most possibly by 12:30 the latest, or 12:30 the latest, not 1 o'clock. Yes. So I'm handing over to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members of the Portfolio Committee. I can assure you, Chair, I'll need far less than 1 hour. The purpose of the presentation is to focus on the facilitation of the ratification of the India-Brazil-South Africa Fund for the Alleviation of Poverty and Hunger Agreement.
For the sake of those who never met you, you can introduce yourself first and then you proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson, for calling me to order. My name is Dave Malcolmson from the Department of International Relations and Cooperation. I'm the Chief Director in the Branch Asia Middle East responsible for BRICS, IPSA and IORA. So as I was saying, Chair, the purpose is to facilitate the ratification of the IPSA Fund Agreement. In terms of Section 231(2) of the Constitution, it's required that the agreement be tabled in and approved by both Houses of Parliament for ratification following Cabinet approval, and the Cabinet approval was given on the 14th of August. The Minister has written letters to the Speaker of the National Assembly and the Chair of the NCOP asking that this matter be brought to the Houses for ratification, and the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor, Department of Justice and DIRCO have found that the agreement is consistent with both domestic law and international law obligations. The fund itself is a head of state level initiative that was created in 2004 following the creation of IPSA in 2003, and it represents a pioneering effort of these three emerging market economies of India, Brazil, South Africa in order to promote South-South cooperation. Just as a little bit more background, Chair and Honourable Members, IPSA, as I said, was created in 2003, but with the advent of BRICS in 2011, IPSA went into somewhat of a decline until 2017 when the Ministers of International Relations and Foreign Affairs of the three countries decided to reignite and reinvigorate the IPSA process. So as part of that, they thought they would, at the instance of Brazil, put together an agreement that would cover the work that had been ongoing since 2004 in the IPSA fund, which is the flagship project of the IPSA forum. And we hope that politically this will all culminate in 2020 at an IPSA summit that will be held in India. Now, the capitalization of the fund is derived from membership contributions of $1 million, which is made annually by the three member states. And the fund agreement itself, the draft, was signed in Durban by the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation at the time on the 17th of October 2017. As I've said, Brazil particularly asked that an agreement be put in place, much as the fund had been in operation for some years, as they had stopped payments from about 2015 and said that their Senate had requested that the payments be covered by an agreement, which is why after years of operations we now have an agreement that's before the countries for ratification. As I've said, the fund is a concrete expression of South Africa's commitment to advancing South-South cooperation, and particular IPSA and the fund is focused on development issues, which makes it somewhat distinct from BRICS, which has a much wider mandate. The IPSA initiative is far more development-focused, people-centered, and impact-driven, and therefore the fund itself has had that focus through the life of the fund. The fund is there to support the international development agenda, in particular for the global south and the least developed countries, and in addressing extreme poverty, hunger, and inequality. The fund, as I said, has been in operation for some years, and there are 21 projects that have been facilitated through the fund. I've included in the next few slides a couple of examples, 9 examples of projects, just so that the honourable members can get a sense of what type of work the fund does. But just to give you a full listing of the countries that have benefited to date, there are 8 countries from Africa, which are Burundi, Cape Verde, Guinea-Bissau, Sierra Leone, Sudan, Comoros, Zambia, and Malawi. And the other countries that have benefited are Kiribati, Timor-Leste, St. Lucia, Fiji, Palau, Guyana, Bolivia, Grenada, Cambodia, Haiti, Laos, Vietnam, and Palestine. And there was an overall project around global quality assurance for development projects that was also funded out of the fund. The spectrum, as you would have noticed from that listing of countries, covers a wide geopolitical spectrum across Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Middle East states. The first example we cite is that of Burundi, which was a project around access to reproductive health services, including HIV/AIDS treatment for men, women, and the youth. And 39,000 persons have been impacted per annum by this project, which was then subsequently taken over by the government of Burundi. Guinea-Bissau was a hunger alleviation project where 4,500 farmers benefited from improved rice cultivation techniques. And also another aspect was a renewable energy part of the project that 5 villages benefited from. In Zambia, 2,000 smallholder farmers were targeted in improving productivity, income, and household nutrition. In Sudan, there was an upskilling of youth project to access jobs where 2,995 youth benefited. In Comoros, it's a food security project supported by the South African Agricultural Research Council, where 1,140 farmers were targeted. In Timor-Leste, there were 1,437 subsistence farmers that benefited from sustainable production techniques and contributions to food security. In Palestine, there's been 5 projects, but the most recent was reconstruction and refurbishment of hospitals in the Gaza Strip. In Kiribati, there was enhancing economic opportunities to improve the livelihoods of small farmers. And in Vietnam, 4,000 household livelihoods were enhanced through improved rice production, 3,000 healthcare staff improving their ability to treat non-communicable diseases. And additionally, the project culminated in the development of an e-learning platform as well as an app for this work. At the 15-year anniversary of IPSA last year, it was decided that with 15 years of experience of the IPSA fund, we would actually do a comprehensive review going forward on the work that the fund has done to date to see if there are any areas that the fund could have some improvement. So during the 2020 cycle, we will be looking at doing that IPSA fund review. As I've said, the orientation of the fund is that it's people-centered and impact-driven, and that it has a direct impact on the lives of people who benefit from the projects. It also works in a very practical and tangible manner, to advance South-South cooperation. And an additional benefit to the fund is that we've been able to leverage the optimum utilization of the UN system through the UN Development Program and its subsection, the UN Office of South-South Cooperation, in implementing the projects. Now, the secretariat or the project implementer per se is the UN Office of South-South Cooperation under the UNDP. The fund is governed by a board, the IPSA board, which has oversight. That's constituted by the IPSA Sherpas in each of the three capitals, as well as designated members under the heads of mission at our permanent missions in New York. The host country always has to be involved in the project as well. And with the UN, the three countries and the host country, there's always a monitoring and implementation project committee that's put together on the ground to assess the workings of each and every project to make sure that it's meeting the objectives for which it was approved. Overall, the fund has made significant and measurable successes and has succeeded in promoting all 17 of the UN Sustainable Development Goals. It's been affected so far in 21 developing and least developed countries, and 27 projects have been completed to date. The amount of money that has been spent by the fund on these 27 projects is $36 million, and there's approximately $3 million remaining in the fund. There's three projects currently under consideration, including quite an extensive project for about $1 million in Sri Lanka. But those three still have to go before the board for approval. The fund itself has been recognized as an innovative model for addressing development challenges and has received international awards to date. Particularly the UN Secretary General in 2017 signaled out the fund as the preeminent South-South funding mechanism that the UN is involved with, and he held it up as the model of best practice to be emulated by anyone wanting to be involved in South-South cooperation. Now, next year, in the anniversary celebrations of the United Nations, the IPSA Fund is going to be held up and promoted as a model of best practice. So that will be quite something that we can look forward to as South Africa in terms of promoting some of the work that we do in South-South cooperation. One new area that the members are looking at going forward is whether the IPSA member states themselves can access funding from the IPSA fund for projects in their own countries. To date, the projects have only been held in other countries as proposed by one or more of the IPSA member states. But we're looking at whether the fund should actually be involved in meeting our own national development objectives. And lastly, the projects are uniquely suited to addressing development challenges of the Global South. Along the lines, each and every project assessment is done on the basis of three criteria. Number one, that the projects have to be replicable, that they have to be scalable, and that they have to be sustainable. And by that we mean that the host country, whether at local, regional, or national government level, have to be involved in owning and implementing the project and bringing resources to bear with a commitment to keep the project going past the life of the project. So having said that, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members, we put the fund agreement before yourselves for consideration for ratification by the House and by the National Council of Provinces. Thank you, Chair.
That was quick. It seems as if you preempted our thinking, because looking at your projects, we're like, this is another ARF, a blesser of other countries. There are no projects directed or benefited our country and society at large. But then I think you need to expand on which projects that you're looking at, if there are projects to be implemented in our country, because I think we also need to benefit because we are contributing as well. And on your preamble, on the treaty itself, you're still acknowledging the Millennium Goals, although they are closed already by the UN. Why is it not Sustainable Goals, Development Goals, rather? Because we are in that phase now for the next 20 years. I think you also need to expand on that, try and explain as to what is it that makes you still stuck on the Millennium Goals instead of the SDGs. I will allow the honourable members, but also I think you also need to share the common challenges between the countries, so that you are able to understand why the partnership in particular, and is the BRICS in supportive of IPSA and all that, and the politics behind the IPSA fund and cooperation. I'll allow honourable members to honourable Bergman, honourable Ngozi, honourable Whip Banza. There are no people that will be provoked by other people. I'm not going to allow that to happen. Yeah, in that order.
Chair, thanks very much. I welcome this presentation. I think it's great when we can do something productive through projects. I'm interested to know, I take it the heads of state cannot sit as trustees on this, so when how these decisions are made and who receives funding would be of interest to myself. I would also then just find out, I know it's South-South cooperation, as you've said so, but in terms, and that it's following a UN agenda, but would it not be more productive putting it within BRICS? Russia and China, although not South-South, have a vested interest in what takes place in the South, and their economies could definitely respectively afford $1 million a month, a year, to do such. Would it not be better to make this the project wing of BRICS and, you know, leverage, should I say, off China and Russia in this regard? Thank you.
No, thank you, Chairperson, and I think I welcome the input. It was very succinct. There are several issues that I want to check. First, on the board, you have clarified who sits on the board. I think what we need to know is how regular those meetings take place, how the projects are generated. Are they country-generated, or does the participants, India, South Africa, and Brazil, source the requests? And what you have indicated the criteria for funding, and it's understandable. My second issue is, what are the synergies between this and the African Renaissance Fund? Because there are possibilities of double dipping. I recall that ARF is doing something in Sudan, I think something. So how do we avoid double dipping? And where does the budget lie in DECO? Is it budgeted on an MTF basis, or is it as per request or as per volume of requests sitting on the board? And how often do we evaluate and monitor these projects? In other words, what follow-through do we engage in to ensure that these indeed are projects that have been requested, they are monitored, they make impact, and the money that we spend on them is properly accounted for. The other issue, before my last issue, is technical support. I think if Member Msane was here, unfortunately she's not here, she would have asked, to what extent do South Africans participate in the technical support of IPSA? Are you seconding people? The board can't just take decisions on its own. There must be a processing and funneling process that takes place, and that usually is left to technicians and experts in the field. Do South Africans sit, and what technical support exists for the fund? And more, my last one is more of a political strategic issue. Maybe as a follow through from Member Beck. India, South Africa, and Brazil, as part, they are part of BRICS. Do we find that in the BRICS structures, the country-specific issues as affecting these three countries, do they not find expression in most of the BRICS project, because it looks like BRICS is a big project treaty or arrangement, whereas this one is clearly focused on poverty alleviation. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I also want to echo the sentiments of welcoming the presentation and also support the revival of this, because I believe that it's still relevant, even if we have other structures, in particular the BRICS, because I think maybe there has been a view from people that since there's BRICS now, maybe IPSA is no longer relevant, and we feel that it's still relevant. What I want to check also, Chief Director, in your unit, do you have enough resource in terms of human resource will be able to run with this project, because it's a big project, and we don't want a situation where you have a project then it just become a white elephant, because there are no, you know, there's no capacity in terms of human resource. The last question is that what is now expected from us as a committee going forward in terms of the processes? So I think we should be very clear so that we assist you to fast track, because as the Chair said, we are a committee which is action orientated. We don't want delays. If there's a bureaucracy, we find ways in a proper way, not in other ways, to make sure that because we've come to work and to assist and to turn around the department. So if you can guide us on that one. Thank you, Chair.
You can respond.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Starting then with what you had said in terms of ASHF and the IPSA Fund being blessers of others, I think indeed that is what's informing our decision to look at the aspect of having projects funded out of the member states. To date, it's not something that has been done under the IPSA Fund. We're not at the point of project identification at this point in time. The IPSA Sherpas would still need to take the decision that the fund can be used for projects internal to the IPSA members themselves. So once that decision has been taken, then the process of project identification would kick in. And I think you're entirely correct, Chair, to signal out the fact that there's a reference in the draft agreement to NDGs. I think that is an error in drafting. The drafting process, I suspect, it has been going for some time, and I suspect that was a drafting, that was in the initial drafting that's never been corrected up until the point that it was signed in October 2017. We can certainly approach the IPSA, the members, to see if we can have a codicil to the agreement that would state that any reference to Millennium Development Goals would now be a reference to the Sustainable Development Goals as adopted at the United Nations. So I'm quite sure we can overcome that misnomer in the draft agreement. In terms of the challenges, as you called them, and the wider partnership supportive of IPSA, the members supportive of IPSA and so on, I think, as I was saying, there was, quite frankly, a lapse in IPSA from 2011. 2011 was the last time that the countries met at political level, i.e. the heads of state level. From 2011, when South Africa joined BRICS at in Sanya, there was a period where IPSA essentially went into hiatus. So in 2015, as South Africa, we raised the question with our member partners of IPSA, Brazil and India, do we still see a role for IPSA? Do we still see a need to carry on with IPSA? Much as it operated very well between 2003 and 2011, not much had happened between 2011 and 2015. Because our assessment was particularly the various working groups basically what had happened was the IPSA working groups had devolved into the BRICS working groups, certainly at departmental level. And of the 16 working groups that existed at the time, there were only about four or five that were still operating under the IPSA banner. Having said that, the one thing that could continue to work, even from 2011 till 2017, was the IPSA fund. The IPSA fund never stopped working, and in fact was the part of IPSA that was the model of IPSA, what made IPSA successful. Now, having said that, Chair, between 2015 and 2017, there was a discussion which then involved the ministers, and the ministers met for the first time since 2011 in 2017 and decided indeed that all three countries saw a need to continue with IPSA. The main reason for that is twofold. A, IPSA has a very particular focus that you pointed out of being developmental in nature, rather than the much broader mandate and focus of BRICS, which ranges from everything across economics, finance, socioeconomic development, geopolitics, from cybersecurity to health, and everything in between. IPSA is far more focused at the developmental level. And to that end, we've now refined the working groups down to seven core working groups and another two that we're examining, where there has been substantial work, and the parties, the various departments in those working groups have agreed that there is substantive work they would need to continue under those working groups. There's around 21 memorandums of understanding that currently exist, and the feeling was that there's substantive work in those MOUs that these working groups could continue with. The other critical difference between IPSA and BRICS is around the question of global reform. Within BRICS, obviously there are two permanent members of the UN Security Council that, although in voice, say that they support the aspirations of the developing world to have representation in the Security Council. We all know that those two members, when push comes to shove, won't necessarily support an opening up of membership with veto powers according to Isselwini consensus criteria going forward, whereas India, Brazil, South Africa are all three aspirant members of the Security Council. So there's things we can say in IPSA which are far stronger in language about what we want in terms of reforming the UN system and particularly the United Nations Security Council. And to that end, when the IPSA ministers met on the margins of the UN now in September, they did issue a joint declaration on multilateralism, which was far stronger in tenure and tone than we could ever have achieved through BRICS. So both at the macro level and the micro level, there's a strong feeling amongst the three that it is a partnership worth continuing and worth taking forward as separate from BRICS. In terms of the projects, yes, the heads of state are not trustees of the projects. As I've said, the projects are handled at the board level. The way the decisions are made, which also answers one of the later questions, is that one or other of the three member states puts forward a project proposal to the board for consideration. The board members that are personnel assigned for this task out of our permanent offices in New York then sit with the heads of mission, and they have correspondence with the IPSA Sherpas at Capital. In our case, it's DDG Anil Suklal, who's the IPSA Sherpa, to discuss the parameters of the project and to see whether there are elements of the project that should be revised, whether the project meet the three criteria, etc., etc. So there's quite a comprehensive assessment done of the proposal. And then the Sherpas give the parties in New York the mandate to have a board meeting to take decisions on whether to approve a project or to deny a project. So that's the way the projects are approved. The Office of the UN Office for South-South Cooperation are then given the mandate to drive the implementation of the project. The reason we've done that is the UNDP has an extensive network across the world. They're represented in every country. Their focus is the Sustainable Development Goals, and they have extensive experience in the implementation of projects working with host governments. So we thought that they would be the ideal partners in the implementation of each of the projects. And frankly, to date, it's worked extremely well. It has been a success story from that sense. In terms of whether this fund could be put within BRICS, I don't think that would really be an option. In the sense that definitely India would object to putting it within BRICS, because I'm sure, Honourable Members, Honourable Chairperson, you're aware of some of the dynamics and tensions within the BRICS space between some of the parties. Also, BRICS itself has its own institutions, such as the New Development Bank and the Africa Regional Centre, soon the Americas Regional Centre, and the Europe Regional Centre. So BRICS does focus on projects through the New Development Bank, which is another mechanism that you could maybe say would constitute double dipping. But I'm sure that having the assessment of IFSA projects and BRICS projects in the same space would allow us to avoid that prospect of double dipping across institutions, as it were. In terms of the regularity of the board meetings, they're required to meet every quarter. But if projects are proposed and have been assessed and recommendations have been made, the board can meet much more regularly. As I say, the board members sit in New York, and it's very easy nowadays electronically to source the recommendations and approval from the Sherpas. In terms of how they're generated and sourced, as I've said, it's normally one of the three member countries that put forward projects, and normally one puts forward projects for your own region. So the eight Africa projects are projects that South Africa put forward, and for the other projects, they're projects that have been put forward by those member states. Sometimes the UNDP or the UN office itself becomes aware of a project, and they draw our attention to that project, and the project proposal is sent to the three countries for assessment. But generally, it's one of the three countries. In terms of the relationship, IPSA Fund and they are two completely different things. ARF is South Africa's own mechanism, its own institution for supporting development as a tool of soft diplomacy. In terms of the double dipping, again, the fact that, for example, I sit in the ARF steering committee, the advisory committee, so I would be aware of whether there was the replication of any project out of IPSA Fund that was then being put through to the African Renaissance Fund. And I'm not aware of that ever having happened to date. So I don't think it's something that would necessarily ever be a problem. Also, particularly for the fact that the ARF projects, except for Palestine, have all exclusively been in Africa. And as I've said, in the IPSA fund, it's us as South Africa that would put forward Africa projects. So with us playing the role in both funds, it's unlikely we'll put the same project through to both funds. In terms of where the budget's located, it's part of our annual transfer payment budget line. The $1 million is every year put into the transfer payments part of the departmental budget that would also include our transfer payments to other international organizations. In terms of monitoring and evaluation, as I've said, there is the element of monitoring and evaluation where into the project action plan for each project, a project implementation committee is put together, normally constituting diplomats of the three countries that reside in the country of the project. So if the project's in Guinea-Bissau, we would then task one of our diplomats in Bissau to sit on the project implementation committee with a member of the UNDP and from the Indian and Brazilian embassies if they have representation in those countries. So that's the way the monitoring and evaluation is done, and they're also supposed to report on a quarterly basis and do site visits to where the project is being implemented. In terms of the technical support, there aren't technical experts per se. As I said earlier, the project proposals are sent through to head office and to our permanent mission in New York. But the technical support we have is via the UNDP system and the UN Office for South-South Cooperation, where technical and expertise resides. There was the question about the country-specific issues in BRICS, where BRICS has got a far bigger mandate and focus, and IPS is more concrete. I think I've largely dealt with that. Where there are these different issues that crop up in BRICS between some of the member states, and generally in the BRICS formation, South Africa plays the role of the bridge builder, where we seek for areas of consensus and common ground to be taken forward, where tensions around certain issues do emerge between various countries. We saw that particularly this year, where the new Brazilian administration took us in slightly different directions from previous Brazilian administrations around issues of the Middle East, Palestine, the Gulf, and so on and so forth. And they also wanted to drop some elements of the BRICS program, like the BRICS Plus and the BRICS Outreach, for various reasons. So it's in that context that the language you see in the Brasilia Declaration that was adopted at the end of the summit is language that we managed to get all sides to agree on. And we feel that it didn't take us too much back from previously agreed language within BRICS on those key issues. And Russia, for example, has agreed that in their chairship next year, they will certainly take forward the BRICS Plus and the BRICS dialogue aspects of the BRICS formation. Whereas in IPSA, there's a far more common ground in terms of the issues that we're concerned about, in terms of our approaches to those issues. So the types of tensions and the need for South Africa to be a bridge builder that we see in BRICS doesn't really find expression in IPSA. There's a far greater sense of common ground on the issues that we deal with there, particularly around around development. In terms of the last questions around human resources, I feel that we, up to date anyway, we've had the capacity. We've never felt overextended or unable to deal with any of the aspects around the fund. There are currently four persons in the subdirectorate dealing with IPSA, and to date we have found that sufficient to deal with all the IPSA issues. Of course, you can always do much more with more resources, but in terms of the current workload around BRICS, we found that those four persons is enough to deal with the issue. In terms, lastly, then, of the way forward, as I said at the beginning, my minister has written to both the chair of the NCOP and the speaker of the National Assembly, asking that both houses consider the agreement and then subsequently ratify the agreement if there's common cause in both houses. So that would be what we would want to happen now. We're not sure whether the select committee would also request a briefing. And I personally am not sure, once the briefings have been done to portfolio committees and select committees, is the role then of the portfolio committee to support the ratification when it comes to the floor? Or that part I'm not aware of. That's something you yourselves would be aware of in terms of parliamentary procedures. But certainly to answer the question is to say that we would now like both houses to provide ratification of the agreement so that it can then come into force. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Malcolmson. I think you have answered the questions from the honourable members, but I've just noted that your summits are not regular. Why? Why is that so? Because foreign ministers, they meet consistently during the UN General Council. What are the shortcomings? Why the heads of states are not meeting the same way the UN, I mean the foreign ministers are meeting in the General Council? And I think as part of our modus operandi, as the portfolio, we would want to always make sure a piece of legislation or any paper that needs approval for Parliament is tabled. But the limitation which I have from the chair is that you come, you table an agreement towards the end of the term, and it's problematic for us. We would prefer that all these pieces of legislation which are to be tabled before the National Assembly, they come early to us as a portfolio committee, because in terms of Section 342 of the Rules Book of Parliament, It is stipulated that the reports must be tabled into Parliament in accordance to Rule 166. And subsequent to that, or before that, or subsequent to that, the committee must recommend whether to reject or to approve that piece of legislation or paper. But now the dilemma which I have, I think we are not approving or neither we are rejecting. But as per the constitutional requirements of the country, a document with an error in drafting, as you have highlighted, we can't table it to Parliament. Now, we need to have time frames in terms of rectifying that particular error, and then possibly when we come back, we start with this particular agreement and table it before Parliament. Parliament is closing on the 15th of December, the staff, and generally in terms of the program, on the 4th of December, we're out of here. So that's the limitation. So that's why we prefer the tabling of bills, treaties, and whatever agreement that needs tabling of Parliament. You prioritize them because that's our priority. In fact, that is our responsibility as lawmakers. Is to make laws, approve, disapprove, and so on. We have no problems with the actual document, except for that error, which has a constitutional bearing on us. So can it be ratified so that when we come back, we have that piece of document in our computers, and when we start as the portfolio committee, our first meeting when we come back will be on this particular issue, so that we table it to Parliament probably in February, and then you are good to go after that, and have a, because already we have deliberated on the issue, there will be no discussions. It will be just to confirm that the error is no longer there, and we know you need a process to consult the member states, and then after, because it can move to the NCOP before we approve it here. You see, it's a long process. It's a long process, so that's why we prefer tabling as a priority. So I hope the department, Luyand, moving forward, they don't bring these documents towards the end of the term. They must be at the beginning of the term, because when they are at the beginning of the term, at least we are also able to ask the programming whip to push them forward so that there's no delays in terms of the tabling and the approval. And our committee is one of dynamic committees. We have not disagreed on serious issues as a committee. We go there, we table things, and we agree, and they are adopted in unison. That's what we want to do for the rest of our 5 years, agree to disagree if there are agreements, because we have different political ideologies in any event. But this committee has surprised many people and many honorable members. I'm just praying that other committees, you know, copy what we do here as this particular portfolio. So that's my piece of 2 cents on the issue. Then you will respond on those. And then honorable members, I don't know what's your take on this. Honorable Ngosi?
I really don't want to be quarrelsome, but I think going forward, as a point for consideration by member states, particularly ourselves, that it be considered that the expertise you have in the department is exposed to how international, our implementation of international, of projects in an international setting takes place. This gives us an advantage of replicating the skills, but also of further deployment, if you wish to multi-party agencies for your city. Placing complete and total reliance
on third party agencies like the UN. I mean, its credibility is not in doubt. But that removes us from following our pound, following our rent, where it is. Where is our rent making an impact in that setting? So I'm not saying that in the court sale we should involve that, but I'm saying now that we're reviving this relationship, it will be important that this type of intervention be at least factored in when you discuss further enhancing this protocol. I mean, this treaty. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Yes, on the summit issue, from the time IPSA started until 2011, the Heads of State Summit was held fairly regularly every 3 years. But then, as you rightly have noted, from 2011 to date, there hasn't been a Head of State Summit. Frankly, the ministers also lapsed in that period between 2011 and 2017. And as I said, I think the only explanation can be that the focus of the three states shifted towards their BRICS membership. So that's why in 2015, South Africa started raising the question, do we still need IPSA? And it's at that point that the IPSA Sherpas said that the message they have from their political principles is that IPSA is still a value to their countries. And we started reviving IPSA at the political level, which was why we held that initial meeting in 2017 of the ministers, two subsequent meetings of ministers in 2018, and then the ministers met again this year. Now, the plan is that the Indians will host an IPSA summit in 2020, and that will be the point that at the head of state level, they will give the political message that IPSA is alive and well, the three countries support it, and hopefully then going forward, the patterns that were present prior to 2011 will then become more regularized. Honourable Chairperson, in terms of the legislation and tabling early, certainly, we'll take that on board, and it makes imminent sense. The representative from the ministry is here, who can report to minister. But certainly, from my part, I'm attending the next Director General's Forum, so I will report that at the DGF, so that all the DDGs and the DG are aware of the requirement that pieces of legislation should be tabled early enough each year in the process for the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee to recommend or to first of all consider and then make a recommendation. Under the rule 166, I think you said. In terms of this particular piece of legislation, then the error in drafting, we will attempt to rectify that. I'll immediately, when I get back to Pretoria, consult with the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor to see the best way of rectifying, now that the signatures of the three ministers have been appended in October 2017. They'll have to advise how we rectify, as well as then consulting the two other member states once we have a way forward from OXLA. But we will attempt to do that all expeditiously so that it can be back with you, as you've said, in time for your consideration and ratification in February. The last input, certainly I take the point very much around the issue of building expertise around the implementation of projects within the department. It's something we have grappled with for some time, particularly in the ARF context. One of the shortfalls of ARF that was identified when there was a big focus arising from the Auditor General's report in 2015, I think it was to see how exactly are we monitoring and evaluating the implementation of ARF projects. And deficiencies were identified in that process. So I think your question or your comment is part and parcel of that, to say that for the IPSA fund, how can we be sure we ourselves have the expertise rather than relying on the expertise of the UN system. So it's something we can look at, and it is something that the management structures of the department are looking at in the wider context of secondments and deployments to international agencies. In terms of the work that I'm responsible for, we, in the NDB, as you may be aware, we've put a number of young South Africans in the African Regional Center to build up expertise in project management and dealing with international development financing, as well as persons that serve at the headquarters of the bank in Shanghai. With IORA, what we did under our chairship is we've established something called the Nelson Mandela Legacy Project, which involves placing interns in the IORA Secretariat in Mauritius. So that's our small attempt to try and address some of these issues. So it's certainly on the radar, and we'll see how to build up that kind of expertise in the department. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Malcolmson. We're hoping that when you come back, you will have a clear direction as to how are you hoping to correct the issue of the summits which are not there regularly. Because it's important that we meet, otherwise, in the eyes of the people, it's like the bricks has bulldozed you. So we need to be certain on whether you are existing in paper or in action or in reality, so that ourselves we know exactly what we're getting into. So some of the those shortcomings which are rectifiable, they should be rectified. So, honourable members, Section 231, subsection 2 of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, it says legal requirements of approval by two houses of Parliament of treaties to be binding and only of certain agreements. And this, for me, also needs the reading of 231 subsection 2 in terms of the approval, that the purpose is that treaty binds SA on the international level only after it's been approved by both houses. Now, based on that error, we can't approve this one as the committee because it's legally binding. Now, if we adopt it with an error, it's going to be problematic for us constitutionally because we are also lawmakers. Now, based on that, we are not going to approve this document. We're going to approve it when they come back with the correct one. I don't know how these members of states signed this piece of document without reading the document and looking at the fine print on the document itself. Probably it was just an error of judgment. We have all the time to look and read on this piece of papers, especially when we got them earlier. So on those basis, Luyanda, we're going to approve this next year, and it will be the first on our agenda if you fast track the processes of correcting the error. So the sooner you correct the error, the better, and Luyanda will be liaising with Lubabalo so that we put it on our first meeting for next year when we come back as Parliament. We are committed in lawmaking. So if there's no further issues, honorable members, what time is it now? Very early, 10 past 11. Allow me to adjourn our meeting. Honorable Shetty, why your books are under your arm? I have not adjourned the meeting. Are you rushing somewhere? Eh? And you're going to lose those by-elections. Okay, I'm not there. So, honorable members, our meeting is adjourned. I know that particular update you always hungry for. You think you're going for a vacation day. It's not a vacation, that thing. It's work all the way. Lubabalo is going to give us an update on this issue of the New York study tour. But our meeting is adjourned in principle. Just an update. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Yesterday, the committee got a only five members were approved, with the representation of three from ANC, one DA, and one EFF. So from today until Friday, I'll be assisting members to make online application for visas. Thank you, sir.
So that's the update on New York. No questions allowed. Thank you very much. You can go now.